Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review. We're here with Michael Lobel, and we're talking about pop art in the 1960s. So if we bring up pop art, many people might think that, first of all, the main thing is the mass media, mechanical reproduction, and so on and so forth. But in your scholarship, you've also pointed to how, at least for those around Lichtenstein's generation, from the 1950s through the 1960s, that the human body and the handmade are also really important to understand. And I wondered if you could talk a little about kind of the interplay between the mechanical and the handmade.
Sure. I think that when people look at pop art, mostly what they see is just sort of flat, uninflected commercial imagery that's been transferred to a canvas, occasionally a sculpture, maybe a print. And in my work on pop art, I think what I have been or was always, what I always took pains to do was to really think about the ways in which for different artists, that process was experienced differently. And that, I mean, artists are people and we all have different sort of points of view and perspectives. And so that for individual pop artists, they experience those changes differently. They approach those kind of issues differently. So I think Warhol's often seen as the kind of prototypical or emblematic pop artist, right? He came up with all these quotes, I want to be a machine, you know, everything I want to do machine-like. And so there's been this kind of template for the pop artist as the classic sort of Warholian type. And so when I started writing about Lichtenstein, it became very clear early on that Lichtenstein was a very different artist. And I've also written a little bit more recently about Tom Wesselman, who's known for his Great American Nudes and his collages. And I think for artists like Lichtenstein and Wesselman, that embrace of or that connection to the machine didn't come quite as easily. I think certainly Lichtenstein and probably Wesselman as well were much more invested in kind of what we would call sort of modernist beliefs or ideas about uniqueness and originality and the artist's sort of aesthetic gesture. And so in my work on pop, I think part of my goal was just to start putting a little bit of a finer point and looking a little bit with more nuance at how these different artists were dealing with these kinds of issues of the play. Obviously, Lichtenstein must have realized that he's mimicking mechanical reproduction in his work. He's really, part of his signature style is this use of these screens of regularized dots, which people often call Bandeau dots. I think that's a misnomer. I mean, they're half-tone dots, and when he uses them in his paintings, they're not half-tone dots, they're just screens of sort of regular dots. So he must have known that he was using a lot of mechanical sort of motifs in his work, and yet in the ways he talked about his art, he often, you know, emphasized the aesthetic, his own sort of gesture as an artist. And so basically my point would be that Lichtenstein was a very different artist than Warhol, and they were very different from Wesselman, and just sort of bringing a little bit of curiosity to understanding how these artists approached dealing with this broader kind of set of gestures which we call pop art.
That contrast is very interesting, because again, thinking about sort of Warhol versus others, you know, if I think of Warhol, I might think that these ideas of kind of celebrity and self-presentation are so central to pop. There's the films that he made and his factory. There was, you know, working with the Velvet Underground and so on and so forth. But again, looking at the other pop artists, it seems like, I mean, not just the ones you mentioned, but maybe others as well, aren't really doing that at all. So would you say that there's kind of this divide between Warhol doing one thing and this whole other group of pop artists who just don't really fit that at all?
Yes. I think Warhol, I mean, it's funny, there's almost a kind of contradiction. On the one hand, Warhol is often taken as the emblematic pop right. artist, like he represents pop art, and yet he was totally sui generis. He was yeah. totally, I would say that Warhol was exploring things in a very unique way.
Yeah.
So who's obviously very committed to breaking down, you know, distinctions between different mediums and media.
Yeah.
He had his hand in, right, everything from painting and sculpture to filmmaking to magazine publishing
yeah.
to recording and overseeing, you know, the Velvet Underground and the Exploding Plastic Inevitable. So he just had a kind of much broader vision than any of the other artists yeah. really who were associated with the movement.
One thing that I was surprised to learn about James Rosenquist was his interest in products that were out of date. For example, in President-elect painting begun in 1961, there's a 1949 Chevrolet, which would have been over a decade old. And as you show in Rosenquist's work, this interest really complicates this idea about pop culture being all about what's new and shiny and kind of endless novelty. And so, could you talk a little bit about the role of the obsolete or outmoded for Rosenquist?
I can talk about that in relation to Rosenquist, and I could also, we could also expand it and talk about a lot of the other pop artists.
Yeah, yeah.
I think one of the other sort of defining misunderstandings or misreadings of pop is, and when I say pop, I mean, first of all, I want to complicate that because when we talk about pop art, I mean, for those who are not in the field of art history, I think a lot of people don't realize that the term itself was developed out of conversations that occurred amongst a group of artists who are known as the Independent Group right. in London, in the UK, in the 1950s. The term gets imported to the United States and gets used as a label for these types of works that are being made by American artists in the 1960s. So even, you know, talking about pop art, I kind of want to specify what we're right. talking about. But if we're talking about the American pop artists who emerge in the 1960s, like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, James Rosenquist, Tom Wesselman, yes, there's very often, not just with Rosenquist, although Rosenquist was very focused on obsolescence, as I talk about a lot in my book on Rosenquist, and looking back to imagery from the 1940s and 1950s. But in fact, even though most people look at this type of 1960s pop art as celebrating and embracing the new, many of them were looking at images and motifs that were at least a decade or two decades old. So some of Warhol's earliest works are of, like, he does an early painting of a candlestick telephone, mm-hmm. which is totally obsolete by that point. He does a number of sort of consumer objects that are clearly decades old.
Wow.
And what a lot of people don't realize, and again, getting back to the painting I was just looking at yesterday, the Modern Art Museum Fort Worth's Marilyn painting.
Yeah.
Warhol begins that painting within several weeks of Marilyn Monroe's untimely death in 1962.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, his images of Marilyn are not only a celebration of celebrity, but they're in fact, in some ways, mourning portraits. They are suffused with a recognition of death.
Yeah.
But Warhol, instead of choosing a photographic image of Marilyn from around that time, uh-huh. say from around 1962, actually chooses a photograph of her from about a decade previous. Oh. And I have to give credit, the first person to really talk about this extensively was the art historian Thomas Crowe, mm-hmm. who's mm-hmm. written a lot about 18th century art, but also about 20th century and post-war art. And so even Warhol's, probably one of Warhol's most recognizable motifs, right?
Yeah.
With Warhol, you get the Campbell's soup cans and Marilyn. Even his very recognizable Marilyn image, which is ostensibly about a celebration of contemporary celebrity, it actually incorporates a reference back to the past.
Yeah.
And that's true of Rosenquist, that's true of Warhol. Lichtenstein becomes very interested. He does a whole series of sort of modern motifs where he's looking back at Art Deco. So yeah, throughout the work, throughout the kind of work and sort of chosen imagery of this 1960s American pop artist, you have almost invariably, no, I don't want to say that, you have generally a frequent look back to the past, a use of motifs and images from a decade or several decades prior.
There was another really important thing that came across, I thought, the way that pop art being not just about entertainment and consumerism, but that Rosenquist, for example, really makes us think about the Cold War and the military industrial complex and these things that are sort of far removed from Coca-Cola and the movies and everything. And so just in a general way, I guess my question would be, what kinds of things do we learn about the kind of geopolitics from someone like Rosenquist? Or
so arguably Rosenquist's best known work is a painting entitled F-111, which is the name of a military fighter bomber that was under development at the time. It's an 86-foot long multi-panel painting that is now in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And getting back to your previous question about obsolescence, the interesting thing about this painting, so again, and Rosenquist was very, very attuned to discussions at that point about the so-called military-industrial complex, which was a term that was floated by Eisenhower in his farewell address to the nation, where he warned us about this growing sort of interconnection between the broader American economy and the military. So Rosenquist's this massive painting, F-111, and in its original version, Rosenquist designed it or painted it for an exhibition at the Leo Castelli Gallery in New York. And so this massive 86-foot long picture of this military fighter bomber that's juxtaposed with all of these other images, a young girl under a hair dryer and a mushroom cloud and a bundt cake. It was supposed to wrap around the viewer completely. So the viewer was supposed to be immersed in this imagery. So it looks like, again, an engagement with the most up-to-date, most current sort of issues geopolitically and in terms of American politics and America's economic dependence on the military, or as Eisenhower called it, the military-industrial complex. But the ironic thing about that plane, which Rosenquist recognized at the time, was that even as it was being developed at the time, it was already obsolete. There had been a whole series of public hearings about problems with the jet actually, its workings, flying. And so what I talk about in my writing about Rosenquist is that what really seems to have engaged Rosenquist in choosing this particular image and this particular piece of military hardware was that it was obsolete. It was a piece of military hardware that was obsolete even before it was brought to completion. And the actual F-111 fighter jet, as far as I understand, was never actually flown in combat. I mean, we could talk about Rosenquist's engagement with contemporary geopolitics, meaning in the mid-1960s, but those of us who are perhaps attuned to current events in our own time might see this resonating with our own contemporary circumstances around the continuation and expansion of the military-industrial complex. And I know that there are obviously politicians and observers, you know, today who are continually sort of pointing out that not only was Eisenhower's warning about the growing influence of the military-industrial complex, I mean, that's right around, that's in the late 50s, that's right around 1960. Not only was it not, that warning not heeded, but that complex has only grown in influence and in its kind of interpenetration into our culture even further in our time.
You know, listening to you talk about that reminds me actually, obviously in the last few years, it seems that there's been an enormous amount of scholarship and exhibitions on pop art in an international context. And it reminds me of how, especially I think, whether it's Latin American or European or even otherwise, artists of the same generation who are looking at the United States and its culture from the outside, they often have very sharp, acute kinds of perspectives on all this. And it's very enlightening, I think, to see pop art as, you know, not just kind of New York or maybe London, but the way that, you know, the quote unquote, the same mass culture is actually really regionally specific and so forth. But
yeah, and there were some, and as you've said, there have been some very interesting and important recent exhibitions that have looked at pop as a kind of global style.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I think there are a number of ways of thinking about this. I think there's the kind of sort of colonialist kind of frame that you could put around American pop, you know, and saying that it was a style that got sort of transplanted and it's so American. It got transplanted or even imposed in other parts of the world. I'm a little bit more open to seeing. And I think what these recent exhibitions have done is to show that in fact, as you're saying, different artists in different regions of the world, whether it be Latin America or Asia, looked at these kind of new approaches to commercial culture, mass culture, and the mass media, and made use of them for their own ends.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about your most recent book about the 19th century painter and member of the so-called Ashcan School of American Realism. The book is John Sloan, Drawing on Illustration, which won the Eldridge Prize from the Smithsonian. And I thought, I can't be the only one who said, okay, Lichtenstein, Rosenquist, whoa, John Sloan, I wasn't expecting that. But then I thought, wait a minute, working in magazines and pop culture, everyday life, you know, this Sloan's work seems incredibly kind of contemporary and very relevant to the kind of contemporary mindset that we might have. So basically, I just wanted to ask, can you tell us a little bit about Sloan as a topic and how you ended up there from your previous work?
Sure. So if I'm allowed to correct you,
you
described him as a 19th century painter.
Yes, please correct.
Well, so, it's interesting. So Sloan did start out working in the late 19th century, but I think maybe we might more accurately describe him as an early 20th century painter. And in fact, he works through the middle of the 20th century. I don't know. I just thought for the record, because we're doing a recording.
Yes.
And I'm an academic, so
yes.
I'm in the profession of correcting, professionally correcting.
Good.
So there were a number of reasons that I started looking at Johnson. First of all, Johnson was a member of this group variously called, different versions of that group are called the Eight, which is after a famous exhibition of eight artists that appeared on the scene in New York City in 1908. And sort of other versions or iterations of that group are known as the Ashcan School. But the thing that connected many of them, well, there are a number of things that connected many of these artists. One is that they were producing new images of the city and its new kind of population, so immigrants and the working classes in the first decade or two of the 20th century, but also as specialists in American art history. Now, many of them started out as newspaper and magazine illustrators. Not all of them, but many of them did, and many of them started out in Philadelphia in the late 19th century, so the last decade of the 19th century. And then sort of as a group, over the course of several years, many of them moved to New York City, relocate to New York City right around the turn of the 20th century, and begin to, well, most of them are still working as illustrators on and off, begin to develop this kind of painting of modern American urban life. And there were a number of reasons I turned to that subject matter. One is that around 2008, there was a lot of attention to these artists because it was the centennial of this major early exhibition they held in 1908. And I attended a symposium and I was reading about these artists and more recent treatments, scholarly treatments of these artists. And I just had this feeling that there was more to say about them.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say something about them, and as it turned out, specifically about Sloan, thinking about their work more intensely around this issue of illustration. And there have been a number of very good scholarly treatments previously, particularly by an art historian who teaches at the University of Michigan, Rebecca Zurier. Mm-hmm. And my work built on the work she did on the broader Ashcan School, and I focused in more specifically on Sloan. But also, I mean, it's funny that you should say it's a little bit surprising, because when I started telling people about 10 years ago that I was working on John Sloan and the Ashcan School, I did get quizzical looks, because mm-hmm. I had up until that point really only written about art after World War II and really art after 1960. But to me, there was, as you said, there was an absolute continuity, because I was very interested in how an artist was navigating or negotiating the relationship between what we might call art and popular culture or mass culture.
Yeah, and I'll just put in another plug that the really interesting lecture by Professor Lobel on Sloan for the Eldridge Prize at the Smithsonian is on YouTube, and it's really interesting. So I recommend anyone to check that out. This is the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world, and our guest today is Michael Lobel. Oscar Olson is our engineer, and Michael's visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History. The Athenaeum Review is produced by Creative Disturbance and the UTD School of Arts and Humanities. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.